I thought about a lot of different ways to go with Moses. Moses was a guy who had a lot of different kinds of temptations, right? Moses is he's an interesting character because he's one of the characters we have the most information about. He's one of the characters we have more of the stories about. It's probably Jesus, then David, then Moses, as far as just people we have sheer amount of information. So as we think about Moses and the way that he lived his life and the successes and the failures and the things that he did well and the things he didn't do so well, one of the things I was trying to think of as I was studying for this lesson, he really struggled with the temptation not to act. Now, David, we looked at last week. David had a temptation. His struggles was impulsiveness, and he was kind of violent, right? He was sort of a violent person where he just several times wanted to just murder people straight up, and we saw that last week when we talked about David. Moses had a different problem. Moses was the kind of person who his temptation was not so much he was impulsive. It was not that he wanted to do things and he got into trouble because he was stubborn or because of any other thing. He really struggled with the desire just not to act at all. James 1, it is likely that you are going to memorize this. And to be honest, one of the things I'd like to do as we go through this series is I hope you do memorize this passage. This is, as I've said many times, one of the most important passages, at least as far as temptation goes. We have these seminal passages, 1 Corinthians 13, Hebrews 11. James 1 is one of those. Blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial, for when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life, which God has promised to those who love him. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. But each person is tempted when he is lured and it's enticed by his own desire, when it is conceived, give birth to sin, and sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. You will probably memorize this by the end because we're going to read it every lesson. And we often conceive of these desires as things we actively want to do, right? That I want to commit adultery, or I want to steal, or I want to murder in the case of David, or I want to cheat on my taxes, any number of things, right? We think of these as active things. However, we could desire inaction for many reasons. The desire not to do something. And James actually talks about this later on, James 4:17. It's almost as if he knew this would be a thing. So whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin. It is sin to know the thing you should do and not do it. And we could combine these ideas, I think, and what we're going to do in this lesson is combine these two verses, because anything that we would be tempted and the desires that we had that would lead us astray and lead us away from God would be under this category of, so if the thing that I could sin in is the thing that I don't do, and raise your hand if you don't like doing stuff. Some people do like doing stuff. I knew this would be less. I need to have like both hands up. Because it's a struggle. I just don't want to do stuff. This is a temptation for me. This is one of the things right here. This is not my only struggle, but this is one of my big struggles. There's a lot of temptations that I just don't have. I'm not really an angry person. I'm not really tempted to anger. I'm sort of even keel, emotionally speaking. But this one, this is the one that talks to me. This is the one that says, Chris, this is your problem. This is your temptation. This is the desire that would lure you away and entice you, leading eventually to death if I let that desire have rule, right? If I let that desire rule over me, that would be a problem. So we think about Moses. Moses struggled mightily with the desire not to do things, even though he wasn't actively doing sinful things. Now, we're going to see that in a couple stories. No greater story demonstrates this than Exodus 3, which gives us insight into the myriad excuses that we use, because this is what we do, right? We have a temptation or desire not to do a thing, and so what do? We give excuses why I don't really need to do that thing, whatever it happens to be, right? I don't need to do it because of this reason, or this reason, or this reason. Exodus chapter 3, Moses. Exodus 3, 9 and 10. Now behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me. I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. Come, I will send you to the Pharaoh that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. So Moses has left Egypt at this point. We're going to come back to that in a moment. But Israel remains. They're in slavery, right? God wants Moses to lead the people out, speaks to Moses out of the burning bush. And the question then is, how does Moses respond? God is saying, Moses, I want you to do this righteous thing. Go and free my people. What does he say? Over and over and over. 3:11. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring out the people, Israel out of Egypt? 3:13. Moses said to God, if I come to the people and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they say, what is his name? What shall I say? 4:1. Moses answered, behold, they will not believe me or listen to my voice, for they will say, the Lord did not appear to you. 4:10. Yeah. And Moses said to the Lord, oh, my Lord, I am not eloquent either in past or since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and tongue. 4:13 and 14. Oh, my Lord, please send someone else. How many excuses? Well, five. Well, actually, four excuses, because the last one's not an excuse, right? The last one, he finally says, fine, I don't have any more excuses, so what does he just do? Don't send me. Send somebody else. Not an excuse. But four times, he gives these excuses. And I think these excuses are things that we all sort of struggle with, right? There's things that we need to do, things we know we should do, but we give these excuses. Number one, right, Exodus 3:11, I am not important enough, or good enough, or valuable enough, or fill in the blank, right? I'm not, why should I be doing this? This, we could talk about this with evangelism. We could talk about this with service. We could talk about this with any number of things, right? Who am I that I should do X, Y, or Z great thing that God has in store? And I think we usually use this excuse more for public things, probably, right? Things that people are going to know about. Who am I that I should do this thing? The second one, he gets a little bit more specific after that, right? If I come to the people and they say to me, who sent you? What shall I say to them? What is that? A plea of ignorance. I'm not good enough. I don't know enough. I don't have enough information, or I don't have enough. And this is a thing that we do as well, right? We don't want to do a thing. And so what do we do to mask our desire not to do the thing? We want to have every detail in place, every possible outcome, every variation. And so we put it off and put it off because there's this thing I could know and this thing I need to find out and this thing I need to have under control and this thing and this thing. And before you know it, what? You're not doing the thing. You're never going to do the thing. You will always keep coming up with insufficiencies because you're not God, right? You're not perfect. So if you're waiting for the perfect moment, if you're waiting to have all the information, if you're waiting to be in total control, you're never going to do it because you're not perfect. There's always going to be variables that you can't control and outcomes that you can't figure out. Now, God does give him answers over and over again, right? Behold, they will not believe me or listen to my voice, for they will say, the Lord did not appear to you. What does God do then? Fine, you can have miraculous power. That's what he eventually says to Moses, right? They're not going to believe me. Here, I'll let you do some awesome stuff. The thing, the staff turning into the snake and the hand and the leprosy. Was it leprosy? I think it was leprosy, or maybe just covered in sores. So God says over and over, answers his excuses, right? Now, finally at the end, you kind of get the sense as we go through this, the exasperation of God building, right? Moses, why do you keep making, fine, you can have this, fine, you can have Aaron, fine, I'll give you miraculous power. Here's what you say. But then at the end is when the Lord is angry. What does he say at the end? Not an excuse, just, I don't want to. And that is when the Lord's anger is kindled. I don't want to. Send somebody else. And the Lord's anger is kindled. And to my knowledge, this is perhaps the worst that God's relationship with Moses ever is. Because there's a lot of things, as we get through the story, right? Moses does mature, and God later says what? I've speak to him face to face, and the whole deal with Aaron and Miriam, when they want to have a coup, essentially, and God says, look, you prophets are great, but Moses is the best prophet. And so eventually God has a great relationship with Moses, but here at the beginning, Moses isn't there yet. He's not mature yet, he hasn't figured it out yet, and I think going through the process of the 10 plagues sort of helps him figure that out. But here, the I don't want to. And I think that's eventually where we get to, right? If our struggle is we don't want to act righteously for any number of reasons, we'll talk about that in a moment. We can add excuse after excuse, but God has supplied what you need. If he hasn't supplied it to you specifically, he supplied it to you in the church, right? One of the reasons we're all together is there's people here that can help us with stuff. There's a lot of things that God asks us to do that we don't want to do that we think we have to do alone, but God never said you had to do it alone. And I don't know, somehow we've conceptualized that. God has supplied what you need at each step of the way, and finally, at the end, what you're going to have to decide is, do I want to or not? Am I going to or not? Let's keep going. Deep down, Moses doesn't want to do what God wants. Why is that? Why doesn't he want to do that? And this is the thing that I struggled with a lot as I was studying for this lesson. Why? Feelings of inadequacy, I think, are a large part of it. He doesn't feel good enough. I think he finally found comfort in his life in Midian. He's been there for 40 years at this point. He has 40 years in Egypt, then 40 years between Egypt and when he goes back to Egypt. So he's found comfort. He's found a life. He's made a life. And I think one of the things we struggle with is we don't want to break the status quo, right? We just want things to keep going the way they are. And I think Moses struggled with that. This is a character trait that I think he demonstrates earlier in his life in Exodus chapter 2, verse 11 through 15. One day, So Moses has been in Egypt, right? He's been in the house of Pharaoh, and things have been going well for him, generally speaking. One day when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and looked on their burdens and saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. He looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. Now, the question I have, first question about this text, what has he been doing for his whole life? Again, we know that he's been in Egypt for 40 years. What has he been doing for 40 years up until this point? He's been living in the ivory tower, right? Not literally ivory, but Pharaoh's palace. He's been educated. He's been cream of the crop, been living the high life. It's not that maybe he was just that dumb. But I have to imagine if he's lived there for 40 years, he knows this is going on already, right? He knows the people of Israel are in slavery. He's grown up in the leader's house. He has to know that this is going on in the country. What has he been doing this long? And it takes him actually going into the moment and seeing the suffering for himself, seeing the downtroddenness and the slavery to really be spurred into action, right? And I think this is what happens. One of the reasons we struggle with the desire not to act is we don't have any real knowledge of what we're trying to do. Moses, I think, lived in this isolated situation, and he had no real firsthand knowledge, I don't think. He maybe intellectually knew that they were suffering, intellectually knew that they were in slavery. But until he actually went and saw it, it's like it wasn't that important to him. Because, I mean, what has he been doing for 40 years up until this point? Now, when he is spurred into action, the text explicitly says, he looked this way and that. What is he doing there? Right? It's almost like he's crossing the road. But what is he doing? He's making sure no one's around, which implies what? What if there had been somebody around? Do you think he would have just let this guy die? Maybe. Right? He specifically has to have it in the clear, I can get away with this thing, and then I'll do it. Rather than, and I presume that's one of the reasons he hasn't done anything until now, there's been no way he could have acted up until now and gotten away with it. Even at this particular moment, he sees the thing happening, but he still has to stop and make sure nobody's going to know before he does this thing. He really, I don't think, wanted to disrupt his life in Egypt. He didn't want to rock the boat. He didn't want to shake the status quo. And so when he goes over to Midian then, we see the same attitude, right? He goes over to Midian and God says, go back and free my people. I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. That would disrupt my life. I'd have to face conflict. Maybe he was conflict averse. That's the thing that keeps us from action, right? We don't want to get into conflict. We don't want to have to deal with it face to face. Here, Moses, I think, doesn't want to deal with it face to face. I can get away with this thing and nobody's going to know, so then I'll do it. But if it's going to require me to confront somebody, then no thank you. Right? I think that's the attitude he has in Midian when God asks him to go back and save his people. Just that he really, I think, does not have the drive to break out of the status quo in Egypt. 2:11, when he went out the next day, behold, two Hebrews were struggling together, and he said to the man in the wrong, why do you strike your companion? He answered, who made you a prince and judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? Then Moses was afraid and thought, surely this thing is known. When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses, and he fled and stayed in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well, and then a lot of stuff happens. to be as little involved as possible, rather than try to stay and make things right. Now, in the end, it works out. Not because Moses is so great. If Moses had his way, Israel would still be in slavery in Egypt and nothing would have changed, right? It worked out because God made Moses do it. God made him get up and go, answered all of his excuses, and then finally was just angry at him. If Moses had his way, he would never have done anything to free Israel. He never would. He would have been over and stayed in Midian. Really, he probably would have stayed in Egypt if he hadn't even seen that the guy getting beat. The temptation not to act can come from many places. I've got this because laziness is one of those, right? The laziness. If temptation leads to sin through the desires of our hearts, the desires of the flesh, desires of the flesh, pride in life, those three things that we've talked about at length, right? What do we desire when we are tempted not to act? Well, maybe to keep what we have. I think this was a large part of Moses' thing, why he didn't act for so long in Egypt, is he has a cushy life and the rest of them don't. Maybe he didn't consciously have that maliciousness, but I do think he didn't want to give that up. Same thing within Egypt, right? Or in Midian, right? Same thing. He doesn't want to go free Israel because he's built a life in Midian. I don't want to give that up. I don't want to give up this life that I've built over here. Maybe we want to keep our possessions. We want to keep our relationships. We want to keep our status. Maybe we do it to stay safe. That's a big one, right? We have this desire to stay safe. And so what is fear but the overwhelming desire to stay physically or socially safe? This is an important thing because I think a lot of us are not really in danger of our lives. But what might die? What might be threatened? My social well-being, my emotional well-being, my monetary well-being. And so this desire to stay safe, and it's fundamentally a fear, again, goes back to this idea of temptation, what temptation is in James chapter 1, when he is lured away and enticed by his own desires. These desires, again, I don't think are inherently wrong, like most desires. They become wrong when we let these desires stop us from doing the right thing, right? That's why James 4 is so important. Him who knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, to him it is sin. If these desires prevent you from doing the right thing that you know you need to do, then you have sinned. You have been led into temptation and overcome by that temptation. And to be fair, I think Moses would have been overcome by that temptation as well if God had not appeared to him and made him go do the thing. But God's not going to do that to you. He's not going to appear out of the burning bush. This podium, this thing is not going to light on fire and tell us to go do our things, right? God is going to give you the choice whether you're going to do it or not. And if we let our temptation to not do things for any number of good desires, right? It's okay to want to be safe in a general sense, I think. But when that desire prevents us from acting, when that desire prevents us from doing the right thing, when we would rather maintain the way things are than do the right thing and risk losing them. And it could be any number of reasons for that, right? Also, I do think sometimes we just can't be bothered, right? I'm tired. I have other stuff to do. I don't want to go through the effort. I don't want to spend my time and energy on doing that right thing, whatever it happens to be. It could be any number of things. I'd rather spend my desire and energy on this thing over here, or doing these particular things, or being with these people, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? We just can't be bothered to do the right thing. Again, if temptation is being lured away and enticed by your own desire, those desires as well would qualify. The desire to spend your time doing these other things instead of doing the righteous thing. Now, to be fair, I knew I need to qualify this. Sometimes there's right things we don't do because we're doing other right things, right? That's not what I'm talking about here, because not everybody can do everything. I get that. The question is not between this righteous action and this righteous action, because that's just, and that's hard to figure out sometimes. I understand that. But I'm talking about rather, I know that I could be doing this righteous thing, but instead I'm going to go do these other things that are not advancing the cause of Christ, or they're not righteous. Maybe they're even sinful things. I just don't want to put the energy into it, right? Well, again, what does James say about that? You know the right thing to do and you fail to do it to that person, it is sin. And I think Moses really struggled with this. It manifests most often, I think, in Exodus 3. And yet the fact that he lived 40 years in a place of privilege in Egypt without doing anything, and eventually just fled rather than face the consequences. Now, eventually we know Moses matured because Moses does get his act together eventually, and God, the way that God talks about him later in his life, Hebrews 11:24-27, I used to think that this was referring to Moses striking the Egyptian, but I just don't think that's the case anymore. I don't think that's what this story is talking about. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the child or the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered the reproach of Christ greater than greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he is looking forward to the reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not being afraid of the anger of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. Why is this not talking about when Moses struck the Egyptian and fled? Because that story specifically says that he was afraid, right? That story specifically says he was afraid of the king, and so he fled. So that's not what this is talking about, obviously. I think this text specifically is talking about after the ten plagues, and he comes and he confronts Pharaoh, and he stands with the people of Israel. He chooses to stand with Israel instead of being back in Pharaoh's house, and he risks the wrath of Pharaoh. And then when he does leave, he leaves without fear, right? When they march out of Israel, and they're going to go back to wherever it is, the Canaan, they need to go to Canaan, he leaves without fear. He's not afraid of the king, and God ultimately rewards that, right, with the parting of the Red Sea. That's the whole point. Pharaoh pursues him, and then he parts the Red Sea, and then the sea comes back, and it crushes all the Egyptians. But I think that's what this is talking about, that he eventually figured it out. He eventually did mature to the point of placing the risk of the danger of Pharaoh, the risk of angering Pharaoh, he put that below the need to please God, right? The need to do what God wants. And God sort of made him do that and get out of his shell. And I think sometimes we need that, don't we? We need somebody to make us get off our butts and do the thing. And then when we do the thing, whatever it happens to be, we do realize its importance. We realize the value of it. We realize the benefit of it as we get up and start doing it. And then we realize for the next time that it's not going to be so much a struggle. We're just going to choose the right thing because we trained ourselves in that way. This idea of the fleeting pleasures of sin. Maintaining the status quo can indeed lead to fleeting pleasures. Right, the temporary, I think some versions have passing pleasures. The pleasure of a relationship you know you really shouldn't have, right? But we like the person, and they like us, we like them. It doesn't have to be a sexual relationship even, but the relationship makes us feel good. We know really that we should not have this relationship. It's influencing us for sin or for bad things, or maybe it's causing problems at home, any number of things, right? But the relationship is enjoyable for the moment. And so rather than do the thing that we need to do, that we know we need to do, and change that relationship, either remove it or change the way that it is, we just stay in it. And that is fleeting pleasure. But if you know the right thing and don't do it, you know what that says. The pleasure and comfort and safety while others risk all for Christ. We talked about this a little bit in our Bible class this morning. Sometimes I think we have the attitude that somebody else can go do that thing, right? Somebody else go do that. And so, again, that can be, we can stay in the comfort and the pleasure, and I'm going to have my own life and do my own thing, and somebody else can go do the righteous thing. Well, again, maintaining the status quo, not having to do the thing, is pleasurable. It can be pleasurable, but it is passing pleasure. And that person who went and did the thing, at the end, what are they going to have? They're going to have their reward, while you, who didn't do the thing, your pleasure will end. Theirs will not, because they are the ones that did what God wanted them to do. The pleasure that comes from the familiar. I think a lot of times we just don't act because we're afraid of the unknown. Maybe this is not a struggle for you, but I know for a lot of people, we just are afraid of what's going to happen, right? We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know how the outcome is going to be. And so we'd rather stay in the pleasure and safety of the familiar than risk and do the thing, whatever the thing happens to be, the righteous thing. Again, you might feel good for a while, but eventually that's going to end because you did not take the steps that you needed to take to get out of your comfort zone and do the thing that God wanted you to do. I talked about this briefly this morning. The devil doesn't need you to suffer. He doesn't. He doesn't need you to suffer. He just needs you to be comfortable enough that you don't want things to change. That accomplishes the devil's goal just the same, right? If you're happy in this life, and I kind of think sometimes the devil would rather you be happy in this life if he knows that that's going to lead you away from God. If he knows that just maintaining your comfort and your position and your status quo and everything's going to be fine, and that's going to lead you not to do the things that God wants you to do, I think the devil would just as much rather do that. He doesn't need you to suffer necessarily. He just wants you to not be in a relationship with God. So if that's what it takes to make you comfortable, if your comfort is that which will prevent you from doing righteous things, I do absolutely think the devil will do that. Why do we think that so many worldly people are so successful? It keeps them from God just as much as suffering does. Comfort can be a curse just like trials. And I'm often asked why God allows, you know, the classic problem of pain, right? Why does God allow suffering? Why does God allow bad things? I think part of it is this. Because the bad things, the suffering, the trials, force you to do things. It forces you to confront righteousness and sin and wickedness. It forces you to confront the idea of God, and it forces you to get up and do something different in your life because of your suffering. I think that's one of the primary reasons God allows suffering to exist at all. Because without that suffering, without those trials, we would just all stay in our comfortable zones and just doing the things that we're doing and not do the things that God wants us to do. We're going to close with this passage. What is it? Luke 12:43-47. Blessed is the servant whom his master will find doing so when he comes. Truly I say to you, he will set him over all his possessions. But if the servant says to himself, my master is delayed in coming, and begins to beat his male and female servants to eat and drink and get drunk, the master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect, and an hour which he does not know, and will cut him in pieces and put him with the unfaithful. And that servant who knew his master's will, but did not get ready or act according to his will receive a severe beating. This is a parable. But what's the parable saying? When the master returns, those who did not do what they knew they needed to do will receive a severe beating, will be punished. The text goes on to say, I don't have it up there, that the person who didn't know and didn't do the right thing, they'll receive a light beating. They'll still receive punishment, but it's not going to be as severe as the person who knew the right thing and just chose not to do it. Which one are you? As you look at this passage, there's three people. The one who does the will, the one who actively rebels, right? That's the second person who beats his servants and carries on in eating and drinking. But you don't have to actively rebel to have the passive rebellion of simply not doing what you know the master wants. There's three people in this, and maybe you're that second person, in which case there's another conversation we need to have. But I hope that you're the first kind, right? The person that when the master returns, he finds him doing his will, doing what he wants. But maybe you're the third person who, you know what the master wants, but you're just not wanting to do what is required. And what does it say specifically about when the master returns? An hour that he does not know, an hour that he does not expect, maybe tonight, maybe tomorrow, maybe in 300 years. I have no idea. But the point is, neither do you. So if there's things that you know you need to do them now while there's still an opportunity.